This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, we're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded with singer, songwriter, and guitarist Jason Isbell. Many of Isbell's fans first heard his work when he was a member of the southern rock band called the Drive-By Truckers. Isbell recorded three albums with the Truckers, then left that band in 2007. Since then, Isbell has released several solo albums. His latest is called Southeastern. It's Isbell's first album since getting sober. Terry began her interview with Jason Isbell by asking him to play the song that opens his new album. It's called Cover Me Up.
Heart on the run, keeps a hand on the gun, you can't trust anyone. I was so sure what I needed was more, tried to shoot out the sun. Days when we raced, we flew off the page, such damage was done. I made it through, 'cause somebody knew I was meant for someone. So go leave your boots by the bed, we ain't leaving this room. 'Cause someone needs medical help or the magnolia. This house, and I ain't going out to chop wood. So cover me up and know you're enough to use me for good. Put your faith to the test when I tore off your dress in Richmond on high. But I sobered up, I swore off that stuff forever this time. And the old lovers sing, I thought it'd be me who helped him. Never seen till you came along. So go hang your dress up to dry, we ain't leaving this room. The Percy Priest breaks open wide and the river runs through. This house on the stones like a piece of driftwood. Cover me up and know you're enough to use me for good. Cover me up and know you're enough to use me for good. Cover me up. cover me up and know you're enough to use me for good.
Oh, it's beautiful. That's Jason Isbell performing a song that's the lead song on his new album, and that song was called Cover Me Up. Jason Isbell, thank you so much for coming to Fresh Air. So you wrote that song for your wife, Amanda Shires, who's also a musician and songwriter and singer. So I hope she liked it.
She did. She liked it a lot. She did it. She wasn't my wife yet, and she's my wife now, so apparently she didn't hate it.
So part of the song is about getting sober and about how she helped you do that. Is it easier to write a really emotional, personal song like this that you said was difficult for you to write before? Is it easier to write it now being sober? Is that making a difference in the emotional quality of either your writing or your singing?
I think so. I think there's an openness that you really have to accept if you're going to make a change like that. You have to be all right with saying, I have weaknesses. And I think that was a big problem for me. You know, when I was still drinking, I thought I was kind of in control of everything in my life and other people's lives. And I realized at some point that that just was not the case at all. And I had to turn over some of that control. And I think it did make it easier for me to open up. There's something that I kind of miss about, you know, those days. It was easier for me to be emotional than it is now. That's not quite as easy. I'm still learning that, you know. It's only been about a year and a half, so I'm getting better at it.
Wait, that sounds like a contradiction, that it was easier for you to be emotional then when you're drinking, but you're singing and writing more emotionally now that you're sober.
Right, yeah. My conversations, you know, could probably take a turn for the emotional, even probably to the point of being maudlin when I was drunk, you know, with her especially. And now if it's the end of the night and we're on the phone, I really don't feel like opening up as much as I used to. But when I'm writing, I feel like it's necessary. I feel like that's the time for it. Now, I'm working on it at other times too. I'm trying to get better at that. But, you know, when I've got a piece of paper in front of me, that's kind of therapy for me in a whole lot of ways. So I feel like I should probably go ahead and get it out, you know, and tell it all like it happened.
Your family lived in a trailer when you were born. Was there enough room for everybody in the trailer?
Yeah, it was just the three of us, and my parents were teenagers. There was plenty of room. We were in my grandmother's front yard, too. We were right next to the driveway in my grandmother's yard. My first memory, my grandmother worked in the cafeteria at the high school where I wound up going from kindergarten through 12th grade. But my first memory is of her coming home after her shift there with those little drop cookies, boiled peanut butter cookies. And yeah, we lived right there in her driveway in a little trailer. It was fine. I thought it was great.
So growing up in Alabama, you were near the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio, which was a pretty famous sound studio created by the rhythm section of the Fame Studio. Whoops.
Sorry, I just dropped
Did you
my
just
guitar.
Ruin your guitar?
No, neither one of them are mine. I don't.
The heck with it then.
Yeah. All right, I think we're stable now. Okay, sorry that you're talking about Muscle Shoals.
Yeah, so did you go down there when you were young? Did you meet the musicians?
Well, there were two studios, you know. Originally there was the Fame Studio, and then, like you were saying, the rhythm section from Fame split off when Rick Hall tried to sign them to a salary deal. They split off and started their own studio down the street, the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio. And when I was 15, I started going out and playing in public. My mom would take me to restaurants because there were blue laws in those days. You had to sell, I guess they still have them there, actually. You had to sell 51% in food sales, you know, so everything was a restaurant. There weren't any bars or clubs or anything like that in Florence, Alabama, or in Muscle Shoals, which was a neighboring town. And you know, in some ways that was good for me at 15 or 16 because I could get into a restaurant. I might not have been able to get into a bar at that age, but my mom would take me out, and these guys were still working, you know. They played on a lot of hit records, but they were still out actively playing, you know, playing the songs that they had recorded for the most part, for people dancing on a Friday or Saturday night and eating Mexican food or whatever. And I would go out and eventually worked up the courage to get up and sit in and play. And once I did that, I became friends with them, and they would have me get up and sit in with them a lot. And I didn't understand at that point in time really the scope of the work that they had done. A few years later, when I was, say, 19, 20, 21 years old, I really got into R&B music. A lot of people call it soul music, but there's rhythm and blues. I got into that pretty heavily at that age, and of course it was, you know, a revelation to think, well, David played on, you know, I'll Take You There, which is one of the coolest bass lines in the whole world. You know, it was really nice to know that, I think, after meeting those folks, because I would have been a little more nervous around them and probably a little bit starstruck.
I want you to do another song from your new album. This is a song about cancer. Not that many people write songs about cancer. And I'd love for you to tell the story behind this song before you sing it, and if it's about somebody who you know.
I think the original inspiration for this, I used to spend a lot of time in this bar downstairs from the apartment I lived in Alabama before I moved up here to Nashville. And gradually, the regulars would start to disappear. And, you know, almost always it was cancer-related. But, you know, over time, there were probably 8 or 9 people who, you know, just would sort of vanish almost before your very eyes. And you know, these were people who weren't having the best life. They were spending a whole lot of hours sitting in a bar. But I think I got that idea, you know. I imagined a couple of folks who were drinking buddies, really, nothing more than that, and, you know, how their relationship changed when one of them got sick. I have known a lot of people who, you know, have gotten cancer and died. I think everybody has at this point in time, but this one, you know, those two folks aren't necessarily people that exist out in reality.
So the song is called Elephant. Would you sing it for us?
Yes, I will.
Said, Andy, you're better than your past. Winked at me and drained her glass. Cross-legged on a bar stool like nobody sits anymore. She said, Andy, you're taking me home. But I knew she planned to sleep alone. I'd carry her to bed, sweep up. If I'd f*** her before she got sick, I'd never hear the end of it. She don't have the spirit for that now. We drink our drinks and laugh out loud, bitch about the weekend crowd, and try to ignore the elephant song. Somehow. She said, Andy, you cracked me up. Seagrams in a coffee cup, sharecropper eyes and her hair almost all gone. When she got drunk, she made cancer jokes, made up her own doctor's notes. And surrounded by her family, I saw that she was dying alone. I'd sing her class country songs and she'd get high and sing along. But she don't have much voice to sing with now. We
We burn these joints in effigy, cry about what we used to be, try to ignore the elephant somehow. I buried her a thousand times, giving up my place in line, but I don't give a damn about that now. There's one thing that's real clear to me, no one dies with dignity. We just try to ignore the elephant song. Just try to ignore the elephant somehow. We just try to ignore the elephant somehow.
That's Jason Isbell performing his song Elephant, a song that's also featured on his new album, Southeastern. Do you have to be in a certain mood to sing that song? It gets me in a certain mood listening to it.
I think to do it right, you have to find that place. And it's hard to find when you're, for example, on a stage with a bunch of lights and fog and you're in front of a bunch of people who are having a good time. It's hard to find, but I've got practice with that because I've written maybe not songs quite this sad in the past, but I've written some sad songs and had to perform them for people who are having a good time without, you know, somehow without bringing those people down, you know. And it's a difficult thing. It's a fine line, I think. You have to watch about the pacing of your set. You know, I don't play that song every night. I had one on a few records back called Dress Blues that I won't do every night because they are just very dark and very personal to a lot of people.
But at this point, so it's like who doesn't know somebody who's died of cancer now?
It's true. Yeah, it's true.
How did your parents feel about you becoming a professional musician?
They were very accepting. I think they pretty much knew that that was the deal. That was what was going to happen either way. My dad, he worries a bit and, you know, usually with good reason. I think there were quite a few years there where he was probably trying to resign himself to the fact that I wouldn't live too much longer just because of the way I was living. But
drinking, you know, and even, what else? What was it? Just the drinking, or were
there were some drugs too? You know, mm-hmm. We were doing some drugs too. I don't think I ever really got addicted to any of that other stuff. I was able to quit doing that long before I was able to quit drinking.
But, were you doing risky things while you were drinking and doing other drugs?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a motorcycle for a while. That's the one that really scared my dad. He thought that was going to kill me for sure, and it probably. You know, it's strange that it didn't now looking back on it, but you know, my mom's always been very supportive. Both of them have, you know, but there was a moment for Dad, I think, where he realized that it was going to work out as a career. And he called me. He pulled over on the side of the road in his truck and called me. This had been probably 8 or 9 years ago, and he was listening to like demos from my first solo record, I think. And he pulled over on the side of the road on his way to work and called me and said, "Well, son, you know, I don't think you're going to need a backup plan. I think you can go ahead and do this. I just wanted to tell you that," which is a big deal for my father because it was always have something to fall back on, always.
So you have a song called Outfit that was first recorded by the Drive-By Truckers when you were with them. And the bridge is advice that your father used to give you. Would you just sing the bridge for us with the advice?
Okay, yeah. Don't call what you're wearing an outfit. Don't ever say your car is broke. And don't worry about losing your accent, cause
a southern man, tells better jokes. Have fun and stay clear of the needle. Call home on your sister's birthday. Don't tell him you're bigger than Jesus, and don't give it away. Don't give it away.
So that's great. So why was he worried that you'd call what you were wearing an outfit?
I don't know. There were certain things that were pet peeves for my father. I think he did want me to be a certain level of masculine. That's probably where that came from. But I know that wouldn't cut a whole lot of weight nowadays. You can't really tell your kids stuff like that anymore, with good reason. But yeah, in those days, you could have probably gotten a black eye for saying, you know, something about your outfit at school.
And don't ever say your car is broke. I suppose
right,
that's as opposed to broken.
No.
I thought it was correcting your grammar.
You should know what's wrong with it.
You should say, it's the alternator, it's the carburetor, need new spark plugs, that kind of thing.
If you can at least know that much when you take it into the shop, you're not going to get run over as easily.
Well, that is good advice. So I want to ask you to do something that I sometimes ask performers to do when they're on the show, and that is to redeem a song, to take a song that most people you know don't really like, that they think of as corny or overly sentimental or badly written, that you actually really love. And so we asked you in advance if you were willing to do that, and you said you were, so you've already chosen a song. I don't know what it is yet, so dying to hear what you've chosen and why you've chosen it.
All right. Well, this one probably isn't as well known. It was a number one country hit back in the 80s, but around here in Nashville, everybody knows the band called Sawyer Brown did this song. But a friend of mine actually wrote it, Mac McAnally, who wrote a lot of really great hit songs, some for the band Alabama and for a lot of other country artists. He's in Jimmy Buffett's band now. Incredible musician, really. He's won the Country Music Association's Musician of the Year 5 or 6 times in a row, I think, or close to it. But his songs are absolutely brilliant. He's one of the best lyricists on earth. And this song, because it wound up being, I think, a top 10 country hit in the 80s, it gets ignored by people now. I never hear anybody else bring it up. But I think it's as good a cheating song as Willie or Merle or George Jones ever sang. I really do. It's called All These Years. She likes adventure with security. More than one man can provide. She planned adventure feeling sure that he would not be home till after 5. He turned on the lights and turned them off again. Said the one thing he could say. All these years, where have I been? Well, I've been down the road to work and home again. And still I'm here until I'm gone. So don't you rub it in too hard that I've been wrong for all these. She said, you're not the man you used to be. And he said, neither is this guy. She said, there's some things you refuse to see. But I guess sometimes so do I. And she made no excuse why she was lying there. Said the one thing she could say. All these years, what have I done? I made your supper and your daughter and your son. And still I'm here so confused, but I can finally see how much I stand to lose for all these years. Still I'm here, so confused, but I can finally see how much I stand to lose for all.
Well, thank you. I never heard that song. It's a new song
to me. How about
that
song?
Yeah, it's really good.
It's incredible. I think the line, she said, you're not the man you used to be, and he said, neither is this guy, is one of the coolest things I've ever heard anybody say in a song in my whole life. You know, you walk in on your wife in bed with somebody and say, and have the wit to say that, even in the face of how terrible, terrible that situation would be. That one, and then when she says, all these years, what have I done? I made your supper and your daughter and your son. I think that is brilliant, brilliant song. Right?
Yeah, yeah, that's really good. Well, thanks for introducing me to that.
Thank you.
So I just want to get back to something we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, sobriety. And I've gotten the impression through your songs and interviews that it's your wife who helped get you into rehab. And, you know, there's that point for everybody who finally has that turning point, but many people don't ever get there. And for many people, it takes years and years of false starts before they do. Why did this time work? Why did it actually happen?
Well, I guess the jury's still out on whether or not it worked, but it worked today, you know. And all the days leading up to this, so that's good. I just really didn't want to be that way anymore. And I told her a couple of times, I need to quit drinking. I'm going to have to go to rehab to do it because I can't just do it on my own. And, you know, when I told her this, I was drunk and I was upset. And she said, the next time you tell me that, I'm going to hold you to it. You're going to have to go. There's going to be no other option. And sure enough, I brought it back up. And she got on the phone and she called my manager, Tracy Thomas, and she called Ryan Adams, and she called my mom and my dad and, you know, people that I respected, and told them that I had planned on doing this and that they were going to have to hold me to it. And, you know, just by them knowing that I had said that, she knew that my pride wouldn't let me back out on it at that point, which was really smart, and it was not easy for her to do, to call those people and admit, you know, that there was trouble. So I'm very, very grateful for that, you know.
So it wasn't an actual intervention. It was more like they knew that you'd said this and you had your pride and therefore had to follow through?
Right, yeah, there was no intervention where they all came together. I couldn't imagine all those people in the same room together anyway, even to try to save my life.
Jason Isbell speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation and more music after a break. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Well, I used to go out in a Mustang, 302 Mach 1 in green. Me and your mama made you in the back, and I sold it to buy her a ring. And I learned not to say much, nothing, so I figure you already know. But in case you don't, or maybe forgot, I'll lay it out real nice and slow. Don't call what you're wearing an outfit. Don't ever say your car is broke. Don't worry about losing your accent. A southern man tells better jokes. Have fun, stay clear of me.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. We're listening to the performance and interview that Terry recorded with musician Jason Isbell.
There's a song I want to close with from your new album, Southeastern, and the song is called Live Oak. And before we hear it, I just want to quote a few lines from it. This is kind of, in some ways, it's like an old murder ballad or a crime ballad, because it's about somebody who held up a train and killed a couple of people on board. But he's not that person anymore. And so the chorus goes, "There's a man who walks beside me. He is who I used to be, and I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me. And I wonder who she's pining for on nights I'm not around. Could it be the man who did the things I'm living down?" And so, like, he's changed, but she seems to really want to like the criminal as opposed
right,
to
yeah.
the reformed guy. And there is kind of an analogy there, you know, with you. And I was wondering, I mean, this is a crime ballad. It's not an autobiographical song. Yet I'm wondering if women who you've been with have kind of liked the drunken you.
Yeah, I think so. It came directly from that. When I wrote the song, I had just recently gotten sober, and I was scared, you know, what else am I going to lose? Because it can't all be better. Everything, you know, the changes can't all be good changes. There's got to be something that you're losing there, some kind of potency or you know, humor even, or some sort of attractiveness, not only to the person you're with romantically, but to your family, to your friends. Now, had I known then what I know now, I probably wouldn't have been able to write that song, because I see that I still have all those parts of me that I want, you know.
Well, Jason Isbell, I want to congratulate you on the new recording, and I want to thank you so much for your generosity today in speaking with us and performing for us. And I wish you all best.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you so much for having me.
No, my pleasure. And so let's end with that song. This is Jason Isbell from his new album, Southeastern, and the song is called Live Oak. Thank you again.
There's a man who walks beside me, he is who I used to be. And I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me. And I wonder who she's pining for on nights I'm not around. Could it be the man who did the things I'm living down? I was rougher than the timber, shipping out of Fond du Lac, when I headed south at 17, a sheriff on my back. I'd never held a lover in my arms or in my gaze, so I found another victim every couple days. But the night I fell in love with her, I made my weakness known to the fighters and the farmers digging dusty fields alone. The jealous innuendos of the lonely-hearted men let me know what kind of country I was sleeping in. Well, you couldn't stay a loner on the plains before the war. When my neighbors took to slighting me, I had to ask what for. Rumors of my wickedness had reached our little town. Soon she'd heard about the boys I used to hang around. We'd robbed a Great Lakes freighter, killed a couple men aboard. And I told her her eyes flickered like the sharp steel of a sword. All the things that she'd suspected I'd expected her to fear was the truth that drew her to me when I landed here. There's a man who walks beside me, he is who I used to be. And I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me. And I wonder who she's pining for on nights I'm not around. Could it be the man who did the things I'm living down? Thank you.
Well, I carved a cross from live oak and a box from shortleaf pine. Buried her so deep she touched the water table line. Picked up what I needed and I headed south again. To myself I wonder, would I ever find another friend? There's a man who walks beside her, he is who I used to be. And I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me.
Jason Isbell's new album is called Southeastern. You'll find a longer version of his Fresh Air interview and performance online at freshair.npr.org. The literary event of the summer is something that's caught readers and reviewers by surprise. A debut mystery novel by one of the world's most famous living authors. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review and an explanation.
Call it the mystery of the missing book sales, and I don't think we'll be needing to bring Sherlock Holmes in to solve this one. In April, a debut mystery entitled The Cuckoo's Calling was published. It appeared to be written by an unknown British writer named Robert Galbraith, who was identified on the book jacket as a former military cop now working in private security. The novel received some good reviews. Publishers Weekly, for instance, called it a stellar debut. But an unknown author trying to break into an overcrowded genre needs more than approving cliches to make an impact. In the UK, a mere 1,500 copies had been sold. By last week, the novel was deader than a firecracker stand on a rainy 5th of July. Then, the Sunday Times of London received an anonymous tip via Twitter that Robert Galbraith was actually a pseudonym for J.K. Rowling. The Times, in checking out the tip, ran The Cuckoo's Calling through forensic stylometric software and found a strong match with Rowling's Harry Potter books. As soon as the news of Rowling's ruse broke this past Sunday, sales of The Cuckoo's Calling soared. The novel has shot to number one in Amazon online sales, and an additional 300,000 hardcovers have been rushed into print. Signed first editions of The Cuckoo's Calling are selling for around $1,000 on eBay. I think my unsigned first edition probably got packed off in one of the shopping bags full of unwanted review copies I donated to the library a few weeks ago. So, like hundreds of thousands of antsy J.K. Rowling fans who can't wait for the hardcover, I downloaded the electronic version on my Kindle. And you know what? The library is welcome to my review copy and whatever funds it may raise. The Cuckoo's Calling falls into that vast Midland range of fiction that I mentally shelve in the I've read worse but I've read better category. I couldn't even find a memorable quote from this novel. The only really distinctive thing about The Cuckoo's Calling is its title, which comes from a Christina Rossetti poem. Rowling has written a respectable urban example of what's been called the Mayhem Parva school of British detective fiction. The story takes place in a circumscribed setting, it's full of oddball suspects, and the killer is affably lurking in plain sight throughout much of the action. Rowling's private eye hero is named Cormoran Strike. He's an ex-military policeman who lost a leg in Afghanistan. We meet him in the archetypal dumpy office where he passes his days staring into the bottom of a bottle and running to fat. Think Hagrid in a trench coat. Strike's fortunes change when he hires a young temp secretary named Robin Ellicott as his gal Friday. Also stumbling through the Deus Ex Machina door is a client whose sister, the famous model Lula Landry, has died after falling from the balcony of her apartment. The client insists it was murder and hires Strike to find out. Investigations ensue. Rowling tries to bring a more contemporary edge to this novel by featuring a beautiful biracial victim and delving into the demimonde of high fashion and hip-hop royalty. But the world here still feels curiously dated. In fact, the first time we glimpse Robin, the young secretary, she's bedazzled by getting an engagement ring affixed to her finger by her stodgy fiancé. Throughout much of the stories, she serves coffee to clients, makes cow eyes at strike, and tidies up the office loo. The most intriguing, unsolved mystery in The Cuckoo's Calling is why, in this post-Lisbeth Salander age, Rowling would choose to outfit her female lead with such meek and anachronistic feminine behavior. No matter, Rowling is laughing all the way to the vault. Another Cormoran Strike novel, in what is already shaping up to be a blockbuster series, is set to come out in 2014. My advice is, if you want to read a really spectacular detective story about a victim falling off a balcony, read Michael Connelly's 2011 novel, The Drop, now out in paperback. His hero, Harry Bosch, is to detectives what Harry Potter is to boy wizards, the top of the line.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith, also known as J.K. Rowling. Netflix recently unveiled its newest exclusive TV series, Orange is the New Black. It was created by Jenji Kohan, who also created the Showtime series Weeds. All 13-hour-long episodes of the first season of Orange is the New Black were made available for streaming on Netflix on July 11th. I spent a weekend watching them all. Here's my review. Netflix's newest original series, Orange is the New Black, has two important TV predecessors. One is HBO's Oz, the 1997 men-in-prison drama from Tom Fontana that paved the way for HBO's The Sopranos. The other is Showtime's Weeds, which, in season 4, put one of its central characters behind bars. The creator of Weeds, Jenji Kohan, clearly enjoyed the setting of a women's prison as fertile ground for both comedy and drama. Her new series, Orange is the New Black, goes back behind bars, but in a way that's more ambitious and ultimately more impressive than Weeds. Weeds was played mostly for laughs. Oz was so serious and so ominous, it was scary. Orange is somewhere in between. Some of it's funny, but some of its scenes, and many of its characters, stick with you. The series is based on the memoir by Piper Kerman, whose character in Orange is named Piper Chapman. Each episode contains flashbacks that provide insight into the past of a different character, a structure familiar from Lost, and before that, from Oz. But while the flashbacks are intriguing and increasingly surprising, it's the scenes set in the present as Piper enters the prison system that really draw you in. Taylor Schilling, whose only other significant TV role was as Nurse Veronica on NBC's Mercy series 4 years ago, stars as Piper Chapman. She displays more than enough vulnerability to elicit our empathy, even though she is indeed a criminal. Though, in these days, when we end up rooting for the likes of Tony Soprano and Walter White, Piper hardly seems in the same league. Here's Piper on her first day in prison, meeting her assigned counselor, Sam Healy, played by Michael Harney. Fans of Weeds may remember him as that show's Detective Mitch. He's looking over her file, curious as to how a well-to-do 32-year-old white woman ended up in jail.
Are you okay?
Fine, I guess.
What's poopy?
Poppy. It's a bath products line I'd started with my friend Polly. Polly and Piper. Poppy. We're gonna be in Barney's.
Barney's?
It's a nice store.
It's a pretty big case. Criminal conspiracy.
That's what they charged me with. I carried a suitcase of money. Drug money. Once. 10 years ago.
What's the statute of limitations on that?
12 years.
That's tough.
Well, I did it. That one time. 10 years ago.
What did your lawyer say?
He said with the mandatory minimums with drug crimes, he wouldn't recommend risking a trial, so I pleaded out.
And here you are.
Here I am.
When Piper goes through her first day, meeting her bunkmates, going to the cafeteria, every step is tricky. If she befriends the wrong person or says the wrong thing, which she does a lot, the consequences can be severe. We, as the audience, are taken along and experience the same steep learning curve. By episode 3, we're as familiar with the nightly headcount routine as Piper is. And by the end of these 13 episodes, we not only know all the characters in this very large, very diverse ensemble comedy drama, we feel for them too. And that's quite an achievement. The cast is so large, singling out only a few for specific praise is tough. But the two biggest names in Orange is the New Black deserve credit for embodying characters that shatter the memories of their most famous TV roles. Kate Mulgrew, who played Captain Janeway on Star Trek Voyager, is almost unrecognizable and absolutely riveting as Red, the proud Russian inmate who runs the commissary. And Laura Prepon, as Piper's former drug-smuggling lesbian lover, obliterates all traces of the sweet Midwestern teen she played on That 70s Show. But there are plenty of others, too, from Jason Biggs as Piper's current boyfriend to Michelle Hurst as a particularly imposing prisoner named Miss Claudette. Each episode deepens our knowledge of these characters, so much so that by the end of the first 13 episodes, they're all three-dimensional and more than a little haunting. And each episode ends with a cliffhanger that has you eager to see the next show immediately, which on Netflix, you can do. But when I watched all of season 1 of Orange is the New Black, I wasn't just binge viewing, I was binge reviewing. And my verdict, after all that, is that Netflix has indeed done it again. After House of Cards and Arrested Development, Orange is the New Black is its third triumph this year. Orange is the New Black is now streaming on Netflix. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.